Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll remember the pilot who helped save scores of lives 30 years ago in 1989 in that Sioux City jumbo jet crash. But first, let's go to the news that broke last night concerning the Democratic National Committee and Iowa's planned virtual caucuses. Joining us to do that, IPR state government reporter Katarina Sestarek and professor of political science at Drake University, Rachel Caulfield. Katarina and Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Ben.
Katarina, let's start with you. For those not acquainted with this term, virtual caucuses, tell us about the genesis of this idea. How and why did they get started? What are they?
Well, the Democratic National Committee was mandating that caucus states come up with a way for people to, for more people to participate and for people to participate who can't be there in person, because for however long the caucuses have been going on, people had to be there in person to participate. And so the Iowa Democratic Party, their latest plan was to allow people to caucus by phone. There were going to be 6 different times that people could join by phone and pick up to 5 presidential candidate preferences. And so that was the plan. And now, just a few minutes ago, the leadership of the Democratic National Committee said that they're recommending rejecting using phones for caucusing.
Mm-hmm. Rejecting using phones for caucusing. I wonder then, Katarina, does that in effect put Iowa's virtual caucuses plan on hold, or the kibosh on it completely?
I guess we don't really know yet, because the official decision hasn't been made. So the DNC officials are recommending this. So it's likely that there will be that the virtual caucus plan as it stands is not going to happen. Mm-hmm. There's still a question of will the DNC grant a waiver from this new rule so that Iowa can just move forward with caucuses as they have before with only the in-person aspect of it, or if they're going to still require them to come up with some other way for people to participate not in person.
And the Iowa Democratic Party has had what to say about this?
So they're saying that they will explore what alternatives may exist to securely increase accessibility from previous years given the time allowed. And they are saying, you know, the DNC asked them to create this system that would increase participation, and they did that. They're saying that they have confidence. They still have confidence in this phone, this teleconferencing vendor that they were hoping would be the one that would make the system for them. But they're saying if the DNC doesn't believe that it can be fully secure, then they can't go forward with it.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Caulfield, let me turn to you for some analysis on this. How big of a setback is this for, if we just put the lens on, focus on Iowa and its long tradition of caucus and first of the nation status?
Well, I think the short answer to that is we don't know yet. You know, how this little kerfuffle between the DNC and the IDP is resolved will determine a lot. And we don't know yet what the resolution is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Is it a wise decision to forego or to be very concerned about these virtual caucuses, especially considering the threat of cyber meddling demonstrated in 2016?
Yeah, and this is the concern that the DNC initially expressed. They hacked into a teleconference that was using one of the prototypes that had been developed for this virtual caucusing system. And so there was concern about whether or not that virtual caucus would be secure. And, you know, when you come right down to it, the in-person caucus is completely unhackable. So if that's the priority, then an in-person caucus.
I've been there. You have too. It's a weird thing, but probably mm-hmm. unhackable, right?
Completely unhackable. I can't imagine how anybody would break into that system. And when the DNC came out with these rules saying you have to provide a way for essentially absentee participation, The other thing that's true of the in-person caucus is it's not really conducive to an absentee voting system. This
right.
teleconference seemed to be a pretty good balance. It was conditionally approved by the DNC earlier this year. And so this kind of sudden DNC announcement saying, nope, we're concerned about the security, we're concerned about hacking or some other manipulation of the system, we're not going to allow you to move forward with the virtual caucus. That really, I mean, it's a pretty big setback in terms of understanding how Iowa's caucus system can be made compatible mm-hmm. with the DNC's mandate that there be some form of absentee voting.
Right. And Iowa has been long criticized for the low number percentage of voters participating in the caucuses, 15 or 16% of eligible voters, I think, right, Rachel, that do this. And it is, I mean, for those who haven't been to one, it is a weird animal. You go into to a gymnasium or some other sort of venue, and you're cajoled, wrangled by people into certain groups, and you have to
get up and move around
right.
and interact.
There's a count at a certain point to see how many have 15, which candidates have 15% representation, and if you're less than that, then you might go to your second choice, right? It really, I mean, I hear you going this direction with your comments that to get more people involved, it sort of has a danger of wringing out what is special about the caucuses.
Yeah, this has always been one of the really unique aspects of the political environment in Iowa. Caucuses are neighborhood affairs. People go with their friends and their neighbors and their family. Sometimes they agree on their candidates. Sometimes they don't, and they find themselves in preference groups across the room. And I should be clear, we're talking about the Democratic caucus here in particular. Mm-hmm. The Republicans caucus very differently. But it really, to me, it has always been reassuring to imagine that there is still some public venue where this sort of interaction and conversation about priorities and policy and candidates takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Our election system, so much of our election system and so much of our politics is completely impersonal. And the caucuses are very personal.
Right. At the same time, probably rightly criticized for the fact that if you work during those times, you aren't going to be there. And you're sort of ruled, your voice is ruled out, right?
Yeah. If you work, if you have an illness, if you have childcare issues, there are a lot of reasons why it is difficult to show up on caucus night. It might just be bad weather, right? It's not convenient to have everybody gather in one place at one time. Having said that, the date is announced long in advance. And, you know, traditionally, when we look at caucus systems, caucuses have always been places where party activists, those who are most invested in the success of the party organization, are most likely to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNC's rule changes after 2016, the primary goal was to make the entire system much more accessible to people who weren't necessarily party regulars, right? Who weren't the people who would be most likely to turn out for these sorts of events.
Yeah, Rachel, I know you have to get off to mm-hmm. teach a class at 1:30, but before you do, one thing that hasn't been mentioned here that I'd like you to explain is the New Hampshire factor. All this,
yes,
right, because Iowa is kind of penned in, and explain how that is that New Hampshire is really watching what Iowa's doing, right?
New Hampshire's always watching what I was doing, and I was always watching what New Hampshire is doing. But, New Hampshire has been the first in the nation primary for over 100 years. Iowa's a relative newcomer to the first in the nation club. And basically, New Hampshire law and state party or national party regulations generally say New Hampshire has to have the first primary, period. Iowa is exempted because it holds a caucus. So because Iowa's not holding a primary, it's been allowed to jump in front of New Hampshire. And now, in fact, Iowa state law requires that the Iowa caucus be held before any other state holds its nominating contest. And so this has been kind of institutionalized, but it's all conditioned on the fact that Iowa has this caucus process rather than a primary vote.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, let me ask you before you go, and then I'll go to Katarina about journalistically what she'll be watching. But to you, Rachel, first of all, how do you see this might be resolved?
I'll be perfectly honest. I'm not sure how it gets resolved. Obviously, I'm not at the table at the DNC, and I'm not at the table for conversations within the Iowa Democratic Party. It's difficult to envision a situation over the long term where Iowa could have some, you know, some ability to get beyond the rules that were passed as a result of the 2016 election. So my best guess is that in the short term, the DNC would have to grant some sort of waiver that would allow Iowa to proceed with its caucuses for 2020. But over the longer term, there's going to have to be a good deal of consideration given to whether Iowa's system can be in some way conducive to this absentee participation. And I don't think anyone knows what that looks like yet. I hope there are some creative people out there who have some ideas because clearly we're going to need them.
Okay. And Katarina, to you very quickly before we go, what will you be watching going forward in the next few days?
I think now we'll just be watching for an official decision from the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee because they'll have kind of the final say on whether the caucuses can proceed without an absentee participation component in Iowa or if the Iowa Democratic Party will have to find another way to make that happen.
Okay. IPR's Katarina Sestarek and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, thank you very much for coming into the studio.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, let's take a few moments to remember Al Haynes, the pilot who died this week. Haynes and his crew are credited with saving scores of lives 30 years ago when a commercial jet, a jumbo jet, with nearly 300 people crash-landed in Sioux City. That crash of United Flight 232 in 1989 killed 112 people, but 184 miraculously survived. Al Haynes died on Sunday in Seattle from a brief illness. He was 87 years old. Joining us to remember Al and that flight, Mid-American Museum of Aviation and Transportation Director Larry Finley. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for the opportunity.
I want to make sure people are aware that at the museum there is a display of the flight 232, right, that anybody can see?
Yes, that is correct. This is the only full display of information about Flight 232, starting with the disaster drill that we held here at Sioux Gateway Airport in 1987, simulating a major airliner crash here at the airport. And it carries, the display carries right up through the memorial wall that lists all 112 names of those who perished in that accident, and two videos on the planning and also the outcome of that disaster.
You consulted Al Haynes, I understand, for this this display, but you got to know Al Haynes quite well, I understand. I'm sorry for his passing. My condolences to you. But let's talk about that crash. We have to remember some of our listeners, many of our listeners were not even around or not aware of this crash. It's 30 years ago, if that sounds possible. Explain the situation Al was in as the pilot of that United flight in 1989, why he is considered a hero. I understand a title he doesn't really like. Let's listen a little bit of, I think this is Al Haynes, talking on to the control people, talking about the situation that he was in.
I have serious doubts about making the airport. Have you got someplace near there that we might be able to ditch? Unless you get control of this airplane, we're going to put it down wherever it happens to be.
Okay, put it down wherever it happens to be. Tell us what went wrong with that aircraft.
On their flight from Denver to Chicago, they were over northwest Iowa when the number two engine up on the tail, the DC-10 had three jet engines. Number two was mounted up on the tail. The fan disc in that jet engine apparently had a flaw in the fan disc, and it came apart during the flight. That one section of that fan disc went down through the tail section of the aircraft, severed all three hydraulic system lines. Those hydraulic system lines control the flight surfaces, the control surfaces on the tail, the rudder, and on the wings. And when they lose all of the hydraulic fluid, they have no control surfaces to make the airplane turn, much less stop once they get on the ground. They use those control surfaces to help with air resistance when they stop. And when losing all three systems, now it becomes a matter of, as they discovered through the teamwork in that cockpit, of using differential thrust of the two engines, number one and number three, the engines that were mounted on the wings. And that's how they were able to get the airplane corrected from right turns only to a left turn to get lined up with runway 22 here at the Sioux City Airport.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of discussion. This is a short clip, 30 seconds long. You'll hear voices of air traffic controllers, and maybe, Larry, you can explain this after we hear this. Air traffic controllers discussing the situation. I'm always amazed at the calm voices we have here, because this is an incredibly a situation that no pilot wants to be in. Air traffic controllers, you'll hear their voices first, and then the voice of the pilot coming in after that.
Sioux City, got a emergency for you. All right. I got a United aircraft coming in, lost number two engine, having a hard time controlling the aircraft right now. He's at a 29,000 right now and descending to Sioux City right now. He's to your VOR, but he wants the equipment standing by right now.
Radar contact.
Okay, so you know we have almost no controllability. Very little elevator and almost no aileron. We're controlling the turns by power. I don't think we can turn right, but I think we can only make left turns. Well, we're starting a little bit of a left turn right now. I mean, we can only turn right. We can't turn left.
Okay, Larry, I'm sure you're acquainted with all the audio from that horrendous accident. So tell us exactly what you described. This aircraft cannot be turned, flown in traditional ways.
That is correct. The first voices that we heard there was Minneapolis Center, which controls all of the direct route aircraft that fly at the high altitudes. They were in the process at that point, right after that conversation, handing the control and the flight control for the ground approach to Sioux Gateway Airport here in Sioux City. And those flight surfaces are essential. And as Captain Haynes mentioned a number of times, he said, with all of the resources, meaning the four pilots that were in the cockpit, he says not a one of us had ever experienced anything like this in our career in aviation. He says, so therefore, it became a team effort of people coming up with ideas, and okay, we discussed it very briefly to make sure that it was feasible, and then at that point, we would institute that particular procedure to try to correct what was happening. It was after they had made an inspection back in the tail, one of the pilots had walked back to the back section and could tell that, yeah, that it was the number two engine had exploded, and that that was the cause of the whole problem. And they were very calm. I think that's part of the training. Captain Haynes was originally a Marine pilot from 1952 to 1956, and then became a pilot for United Airlines in 1956. So he had a lot of experience flying various aircraft, both military and civilian.
Mm-hmm. When if you watch this video, and of course you can go online to watch Flight 232 crash landing in Sioux City in 1989, when you watch that video, it is incredible to know that a 184 lived when it became an inferno very quickly. How did so many people live?
So many people lived, I think, due to, number one, the teamwork in the cockpit, the teamwork of the flight attendants back in the passenger compartment of preparing people for the impact with the ground. It also is a testament to emergency preparedness here at in the Siouxland area. Less than 2 years earlier, we had the disaster drill here at the airport. We incorporated all of the emergency service people, both paid and volunteer, from the three-state area. We incorporated the medical facilities and the doctors so that everyone had an advanced knowledge that, okay, in the event that this would ever happen in the future, we know what to do. And at the time of the disaster drill, there was a lot of comments made about, well, no aircraft that size ever uses Sioux City Airport. And our response was, that is absolutely correct. But on a clear day, look up in the sky and look at those vapor trails. Those are some of the aircraft that carry 200, 300, 400 passengers. And what if they need to make an emergency landing someplace?
Right. Wow.
And that was the basis for that disaster drill in October of 1987.
Amazing that that took place, and how fortunate for the survivors, the 184 who lived. Larry Finley, let's devote the last couple of minutes to talking about Al Haynes. Tell us about Al, perhaps away from his piloting career. This came to define him after that. What was he like as a person?
As a person, he was very community-oriented. He was a great family man, a father, a husband, a dad. He was very active in the Seattle area where he lived in Little League. He was a Little League umpire for 35 years in the Seattle area. He did 25 years as a stadium announcer for two high school football teams. And he retired from those positions just a few years ago. He was still actively, even though he had, subsequent to the air crash, he had lost his wife due to health issues. He had lost a child due to a motor vehicle accident. But Al was still very committed to the community. He was very committed to disaster preparedness. Shortly after he recovered from the crash, he developed an 88-minute presentation, a multimedia presentation on disaster planning, on teamwork, and being prepared for various types of emergency, and how to put your ego away and work with other people to lessen a severe situation. And he did his last presentation just about 2 years ago. But he always considered those several thousand presentations that he did in that 30-year time period as a way to give back to society, to say that, okay, I made it through a crash like this, but I still feel that I have something to contribute to make society better, to make people know more about how to respond in an emergency situation.
Thank you very much. Larry Finley, a Mid-American Museum of Aviation and Transportation Director, talking about Al Haynes, who died this week at the age of 87. The pilot, you said there were four in the cabin there, and the crew in the back were also responsible for helping to save 184 of those lives. Thank you very much, Larry, for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity. I truly appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll talk about efforts to improve the state's water quality. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, a conversation with the new head of the Iowa National Guard, Major General Ben Correll, will be joining me in just a moment. But first, this month, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, announced the University of Iowa will receive a $1 million, a little bit over $1 million, a farmer-to-farmer cooperative agreement to fund a project that improves water quality, habitat, and environmental education. Joining me to tell us what that's all about, Craig Just, Associate Professor, Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. Craig, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
big long name, connecting rural and para-urban farmers to demonstrate and disseminate innovative nutrient and sediment reduction practices.
Yeah, that's what happens when academics get to make up a title for a grant.
Right. Now you're going to translate it.
Yes,
I hope.
Will. Yeah, what this farmer-to-farmer grant is all about, it's part of the Gulf of Mexico program that the EPA has that's been longstanding. And as many Iowans know, you know, we make a little bit of a contribution to Gulf hypoxia down in that part of the world with the transport of our nutrients. And so it wasn't a hard sell to, propose to EPA that we do some work up here in Iowa on water quality for the sake of benefiting the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, we have, you know, issues right here in Iowa with our own algal blooms and different things like that, too. So it's incentive enough for us to protect our water quality here as best we can, but that's part of the overall framework that we're in. The farmer-to-farmer part of the overall program name reflects the program's desire to have some conversations about water quality. And for us, and the whole concept of peri-urban in the title of this particular grant reflects the fact that a lot of the work we want to do or some of the conversations we want to have will occur out at the historic Johnson County Poor Farm, which is right on the edge of town. Works its way out towards Clear Creek Watershed, where there's some rural farmers, rural producers doing their work. And then we want to have some urban consumers come together and chat with folks, have some conversations about water quality so we can talk about the challenges, but then also develop that preferred future together.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about this farmer-to-farmer relationship, because we have in Iowa, have for many years, had this nutrient reduction strategy. Comment on this current voluntary nutrient reduction strategy. Is it the most effective way to clean up our waterways to protect habitat and also drinking water?
Well, is it the most effective? It could be, as long as we're willing to acknowledge the rate at which we are working towards solving the problem, as long as we're willing to measure the actual water quality and measure that progress over time and then react to that. There are certainly, I was with a group of farmers yesterday up in the Miller Creek watershed up near LaPorte City. And clearly the producers are, you know, into voluntary sorts of agreements and protocols. And those farmers are doing quite well under that framework. They're challenging themselves. They're talking to each other. They're making real progress. I think the challenge comes when you've got some producers who aren't engaged at all in the voluntary process, and then you wonder if we're ever going to reach the magnitude of change needed to solve the problem. So perhaps a combination of both in the end, but hopefully we can make the progress we need under one framework or another.
Mm-hmm. Do you see those who are not complying or not doing anything voluntarily to reduce the nutrients in our streams? And we have to remember what the nutrients, you talked about the algal blooms. There's a lot of the drawback to having this many nutrients in our waterways, right?
For sure. Not only the algal blooms, if we want to have our dogs play in the water, if we want to swim in the water, but then that nitrate that ends up in the water, we have to remove that for drinking water purposes. Here at the University of Iowa, in our drinking water treatment plant on the Iowa River, we just installed a $7 million nitrate removal system. And so somebody is going to pay for that pollution on one end or the other.
Mm-hmm. And to get the people who are not complying, who don't seem to show any interest in nutrient reduction, what's the answer there? Is it awareness raising, or will you just have to say at some point, not voluntary anymore, guys? We tried voluntary, and now we've come to a point we value our water so much we need to sort of have a measurable way to enforce this.
Yeah. I mean, there may come a day when there has to be regulation for folks that are the most recalcitrant out there on the land, as long as, I guess, in my view, that then we don't inhibit the efforts. We want to reward the efforts of those who are doing the good things today. Mm-hmm. And then if we need to, be a little bit more forceful for those that aren't complying and participating today, then, you know, we need to do that as well.
Talk a little bit more about the resources you can offer to farmers as we end this conversation and how people can find out more information.
Yeah, we have the full backing of the Iowa Flood Center and all the technology that it has, and a lot of the producers that we work with appreciate having the data that an organization like that can provide so that then they can make smart choices. We also think that there could be some management strategies on the field that we might be able to help farmers with, as well as putting some of these field scale side of field practices in to treat that nitrate before it ends up getting into our waterways. And we think producers would be happy to work with us on those sorts of things.
Right. And you mentioned the flood center. Flood mitigation and nutrient reduction can go hand in hand, right? Explain that a bit.
Yeah. In fact, one of the things, I actually have two of these EPA grants, and the other one is called the Flood First Approach to Water Quality Improvement in an Iowa Watershed. And if you do talk to producers about, and rural Iowans in these, in rural communities about floods, they know that's a big deal. And so if you can put in flood control wetlands, for example, that'll mitigate the flooding on the landscape, but also treat the nutrients. And increasingly, the farmers, even in the rural landscape, are losing row crop productivity due to flooding. And so it can be farmers helping themselves if they're willing to take a little bit of land out of production, put in some flood control structures, distribute it out in the landscape. That can mitigate the flooding and improve water quality. That's the, we call that the watershed approach.
Right, and it really is. And I've seen this firsthand. I was up not too long ago in Storm Lake, a place that had so much in it, you could almost walk across the lake. It had so much in it. They incorporated some wetlands up there. It's now a much more beautiful lake. And these wetlands, they're what, like nutrient sponges? What happens there?
Yeah, you might think about it. They're certainly, they don't just sponge it up, but then they process it and then essentially exhale nitrogen gas and return it back to the atmosphere. So it is a removal of nitrogen from the system. So it's a very powerful way to mitigate our nitrogen issues. So you take it from that soluble phase in the water, microbes process it, and then out comes nitrogen gas, bubbles away. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you can fix the problem long term.
Mm-hmm. And of course, farmers, as they should be, are also interested in their bottom line. Do you think we can reduce nutrients in our waterways without impacting negatively the bottom line of farmers all around the state?
I think the phrase that I increasingly hear farmers using is profitability. One of the things that I think is a challenge when you're, if your only metric of success is bushels of corn per acre, you know, that's really, in a lot of ways, can be the race to the bottom. Ultimately, it's profitability, and you can be profitable. Again, if you're avoiding some of these losses due to floods because you're maintaining your land well, that contributes to the bottom line just as well as the, you know, maximum amount of bushels per acre. So profitability is really the word, and farmers know they can do it.
Okay. Craig Just, thanks for dropping into our studio. Associate Professor, Civil Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. Glad to have you with us, Craig.
Thanks so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the Iowa National Guard has a new leader, Major General Ben Correll. Kim Reynolds named him Adjutant General at a ceremony earlier this month at Camp Dodge in Johnston. As Adjutant General, Correll will oversee 9,000 soldiers and airmen. I'm very happy to welcome him to this conversation, Major General Ben Correll, in our Des Moines studio. Welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Kiefer. Let me say it's a privilege for me to be sitting here today. And when I found out I had the opportunity to come have a discussion with you, I jumped right on it because I think the people of Iowa are wondering who this Ben Correll from Strawberry Point, Iowa is, and we'll start that conversation. Thanks.
Well, let's start right there. Tell us a little bit about your background and your experience in the military. You were born in Manchester, also in northeast Iowa, but raised in Strawberry Point, right?
Right. So being born in Manchester, when you come from that area of the state, it's only because that's the closest hospital for many miles. And so Delaware County Memorial is where I was born, but I was raised in Strawberry Point, and I'm very proud of that. I was really influenced by my grandparents growing up, hardworking farm-focused people from a farming community. They taught me the values that I've grown up with and that I live by today. You know, they lived in a farmhouse that didn't have indoor plumbing. We carried buckets of water in from the pump house about 100 yards from the house, and we had an outhouse out back. And they taught me about hard work. They taught me about responsibility. I graduated high school. I married my high school sweetheart from Starmont High School up there in northeast Iowa. And this was in the early 80s. We went to work on the family farm. and kind of a tough time for the family farmers in the early 80s. And I decided in 1985 that my wife and the three children that we had, I needed to find a different way of life. Mm. And so as going through the want ads, I found an ad about the Iowa National Guard. And it said, serve part-time, make a decent living. And they had a nice little cash bonus incentive that motivated me to raise my hand and become a member of the Iowa National Guard at that time. And, I thought I would do my 6 years, take my cash bonus, earn a little bit extra money for my family, and then move on. And somewhere along the line, it grew in importance to me, even as a part-time soldier, because that's how I started out. I owned my own business up in Starberry Point. I had a BP Amoco petroleum distribution company with my brother-in-law for many years. It was just like the commercial said, 1 week in a month and two weeks in the summer once you get your initial training done. And we started getting busy in the reserve components around 9/11.
Yep.
And so my first deployment was into Saudi Arabia. I thought that would be my one and only opportunity to deploy as a National Guardsman, because prior to that, we were more of a strategic reserve for our military. And, Cold War times, we thought only if the former Soviet Union tried to charge through the Fulda Gap in Germany would they ever consider using the National Guard or the Reserve. And who would have guessed where we've come to today?
Right.
I just finished up my sixth deployment overseas as the division commander of the 34th Red Bull Infantry Division, and just got back about a month ago.
From Kuwait, right?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. So it's been a busy month for me. Hit the ground here, and the governor, she gave me a call, and she entrusted into me the responsibility to oversee the men and women of the Army and the Air National Guard of the state of Iowa.
Mm. That's a nice introduction. We have a good sense of where you've been and how you got to this point and your upbringing here in Iowa. From this point forward, what do you see as your primary goals with the Iowa National Guard?
Well, I've had some great leaders who I've worked for in the Iowa National Guard. When I first joined, Major General Lawson and his team was the Adjutant General, followed by Major General Ron Dardis. And then Major General Tim Orr, and I've been blessed to work directly for General Orr for a number of years, and so really what I want to do is expand the great things that he did in his tenure as the Adjutant General. My responsibility, it really falls into two categories. I have the responsibility to man, train, and equip, prepare the readiness of these forces of the Iowa National Guard in case the federal government, the National Command Authority, needs these forces for a active duty mission. Mm-hmm. Second to that is for the Homeland Defense, the state of Iowa, the governor, the people of Iowa, is that we are we're prepared, we have the equipment, we have the training, we have the skills that we can respond to the needs of the state of Iowa and the governor in those times of disaster. And over my 33-plus years of service, we've responded a number of times within the state, whether it's a snowstorm where we send out teams to assist drivers who are in trouble, whether it's the floods, and there's probably, in my career anyway, 8-10 different times that I've been called out to respond to the needs of the citizens of Iowa for flooding or tornadoes. And that on occasion happens. And we are not the first responders. We are there to augmentate the capabilities of the local government, the local response teams. And then we work hand in hand with the Iowa Department of Homeland Security Emergency Management, where we will receive missions through them to go out for a specific task to support the citizens of Iowa. And that's really... from a thumbnail sketch, that's what we're here for, mm-hmm. Is either to respond to the needs of the National Command Authority or respond to the needs of the people of Iowa. And that's really where we're focused.
Major General Ben Correll is with us. If you just joined us, Adjutant General, new head of the Iowa National Guard. I'm glad you were talking about the things you were, because the Iowa National Guard has been assisted not only here in Iowa during flooding and other types of tornado, storm recovery, but the Iowa National National Guard is called to go to other states. And I'm looking at my screen, Major General Correll, now about the updates. I'm sure you have an eye on Hurricane Dorian bearing down on Florida, expect to be this monstrous Category 4 storm by the time it gets to Florida early next week. Is this a point where you're making ready for potentially helping out there in that aftermath? Or what would you see your role as? Has any communication happened?
Absolutely. I mean, this is our, you know, one of our highest skills, and that's why we are a trusted agent, whether it's the Iowa National Guard or the National Guard across the 54 states, districts, and territories, is we plan for these. And the time to prepare and execute training to be ready to respond is long before there's any indication of some type of a natural disaster that's inbound. So we have been in communication with the National Guard Bureau. We continue to maintain contact and visibility with our operations centers to be prepared. There's been a number of discussions to this point, specifically through the Florida governor, through the Florida TAG, Adjutant General from Florida, and it's really a cooperation, collaboration as far as how we prepare to respond. And typically, we look at worst-case scenario, and that's what we prepare for. So if it's less than that, we don't have to send as many resources into to respond to establish the way forward to get that community or number of communities or area of the country back on its feet again. And we are in discussions as far as what we would be able to supply as far as resources to assist if needed.
Mm-hmm. At what point do you expect to know when Iowa National Guard guardsmen and women will deploy to Florida? What are you looking at in the next few days? How will you know?
Well, that's a great question, and it kind of goes back to who we are as guardsmen. You know, we've built our history on the shoulders of the early militiamen with our country was founded upon, and so my response is we're always ready, and all they need to do is call. And you know, taking it back down a little bit finer, we need to see what the damage is from this incident, what the needs are, who can supply what. And so it'll be as the incident occurs, and then assessments from the people on the ground, because again, it's similar to what we do here in the state of Iowa. We let the people that are closest to the community, the people from the community, make the assessment, and then identify what resources exactly do we need, or do we believe that we need to get moving that direction.
Mm-hmm. How do you deploy? Is that all over land when you're asked to deploy to Florida?
Not necessarily. It's a number of ways, and it depends, you know, where that request come from. We've got the capability within Iowa to move people through fixed-wing aviation, military, rotary-wing aviation, or we move by ground. And it really depends what is the resource that's been requested Iowa could provide, and that will determine how we would get there and how fast we would get there. You know, obviously, we're not going to be the first ones on the ground. We are going to be a follow-up resource that would come in for a specific need that can't be met by the local law enforcement, local Florida National Guard. I'm sure that there will be federal assets that would be involved. FEMA would be involved. It'll be a whole of government approach as far as identifying what is needed, because there's probably no sense in sending a bunch of military assets down there to respond if they don't have a specific mission. You get too many people on the ground that don't have a specific job or specific reason why they're there, and we're really not posturing ourselves for success, because there could be needs for them elsewhere that we haven't identified yet.
Major General Ben Correll, Adjutant General of the Iowa National Guard, what a pleasure to have you in our studio today. I look forward to future conversations as your tenure at the National Guard develops.
Thanks for having me. It's a privilege for me to, number one, have been asked by the governor to come in and take the helm of the Iowa National Guard. It is a challenge. It's a big responsibility, but I have a great team that works with me every day to help me guide, help me put policy into place, and help me move the National Guard into the future and keep it a trusted agent for the citizens of Iowa and the people of the United States. Thanks much, Ben.
Thank you very much, Major General Ben Correll. Well, let's finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News with by going to Mark Simmet of Iowa Public Radio Studio One. Tracks, Mark, take us out with something for the weekend. Not much time. What do you got for us?
Yes, Ben, we have a band from our neighboring state of Wisconsin. They are Bon Iver. A lot of people looking forward to the new album, and it's out now. It's called I. Justin Vernon starting this band. He's a native of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And here's a track from that new record. It is called Naeem.
All along of my Kinnear, I go for the cast, I fall off a bass boat, and the concrete's really slow.
Make sure you check out Iowa Public Radio's Studio One offerings. Mark Simmet there, thank you so much, grooving us into the weekend with Bon Iver. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rip Brewer, and Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
I can hear crying. I can hear cry. I can hear you. I can hear you cry.